Awesome. Anyway, I'm Candace Tunis. It's really nice to see you guys again. I'm really honored that you guys have invited me back. I enjoy coming and talking to you all about different things about the hand and the wrist. Done kind of different combinations of injury talks the last few years, and today I thought I would spend a little bit more time, because I think these are tough, about ligament injuries around the hand and the wrist. So I have no financial disclosures to make. These are the just a sprain, which I always laugh because I've broken my wrist and I've sprained my wrist, and I really think that the sprains, these soft tissue injuries, take just as long, if not longer, to sort of feel normal than do fractures. They're often more painful, longer recovery. And just to kind of be clear, you know, the ligaments, as we know, are the supporting structures around the joints, and the tendons are the things that move the joints. I'm not going to really go over tendon injuries today, so I'm not going to talk about mallet fingers, jersey fingers. These are more really the true joint injuries. But actually, I mean, any joint can really be affected in the hand. I'm talking about the more common ones. And the treatment can be extremely variable. You can need everything from really urgent surgery to just some buddy tapes and kind of everything in between. So we'll kind of go joint by joint and go over that. So first we'll start with probably the most common thing that anybody will see, and it certainly is one of the most common injuries that I see in my clinic, and that's your PIP sprain. And you might remember I'll toss these little, you know, these abbreviations out, but just to remind everybody, you know, the DIP is your distalmost joint, that's where you'll have mallet injuries. And jersey fingers. PIP is the central joint, MCP where the finger joins the hand, and then down here we'll talk some about the intercarpal injuries and also distal radial ulnar joint, or DRUJ injuries here. So for PIP injuries, these are your jammed fingers, and it's almost impossible in my opinion to distinguish a fracture from just a sprain. I mean, people will come in and they'll be bruised and sore and swollen, and I'll say, oh, that's probably has a fracture, and then I'll check an x-ray, nothing, and vice versa. I'll think, oh, that's probably not that bad, not that swollen, and there'll be a fracture. So it's very hard to tell just by looking at it what's what. But I can't harp on this enough. I'm sure everybody's probably heard me say this before, is anything that you pop back in, any kind of dislocation that you reduce on the field or wherever, needs an x-ray, because they very commonly will have fractures associated with them. But for just the basic sprain, this is the most common injury. They'll tend to be tender over the collateral ligaments, which are the side supporting structures, or potentially the volar plate, which is the strong supporting structure on the palm side of that joint, because these usually they're kind of jammed or hyperextended, and one or of these three injuries or three structures will tend to get damaged. Again, you want to make sure there's not a fracture or a dislocation, and then we'll talk a little bit about a traumatic boutonniere later. These do not splint. As long as the joint is in place and the tendons are all working and there's no fracture, these get moving right away. So these get buddy taped, and everybody probably knows how to buddy tape. You know, you take a little half-inch athletic tape, leave the joint free, so then that allows the joint to remain mobile, but it protects from the side-to-side motion. I tend to find, you know, which collateral ligament are they more tender on? Where do they, if they're going to have a little stress or a little instability, which side is that? And then I tape that. It's like, say for this one, if they were, you know, tender more on the radial collateral ligament, I'd tape towards the middle finger here. So a little bit more severe injury. These are the dorsal dislocations, much more common than the volar dislocations. These are very common, and most of you will probably come across these at some point. You'll pop them back in the field because they can actually be reduced fairly easily without anesthesia. You know, you can kind of get away with just pulling on it and it'll probably go back in, but I like to try to, and I don't get these acutely too much anymore, but I like to kind of hyperextend the finger to try to perch this concave surface of the middle phalanx kind of onto the edge of the proximal phalanx and then sort of flip it over. I think that's a little bit of a more elegant way to reduce them. But again, if you pop it back in, check an x-ray, because this part can often get fractured. You know, the volar plate is the main supporting structure, and sometimes the volar plate just tears, like in this case, and there's no fracture. But sometimes what will happen is that the volar plate will pull a big chunk of this bone off, and if that's the case, and if it's a big enough chunk, then the joint will slowly drift back out of place, and I'll see at least one of those a year. You know, pop back in, fine, moving it, and then they come see me 3 weeks later and the joint is either subluxated or fully dislocated again. So with associated fracture, a lot of those will end up needing a surgery. If they're not, if there's no fracture or they're stable injuries and it's just a little teeny piece, I'll splint them maybe for a week just to let the soft tissues kind of calm down and just a little bit of flexion because that's more stable, and then I get them moving. But this is what they will kind of look like, and sometimes off to the side, and again, hyperextension, and then kind of flip it over the proximal phalanx. Volar dislocation, much less common. And these are harder because these are sometimes, you can't get these back in sometimes. What happens here is the middle phalanx gets forced out volarly. And in order to do that, you have to tear some sort of combination of the structures on the dorsal aspect. So these actually will tend to tear the central slip, that basically a portion of the extensor tendon there at the PIP. But what will happen is that a lot of times the proximal phalanx will buttonhole through some of those dorsal structures and you just can't get it back in. So I have sometimes needed to take these to the operating room to get back in. Once they're back in place, these are more stable in extension. So as opposed to the dorsal dislocations, which are more stable in flexion, these need to be splinted in extension, and we leave the DIP free to kind of get that moving to stretch the lateral bands out. But if you come across one of these and you try to reduce them, basically you want to take all the flexor tendons out of the equation. So you flex everything down, and then you gradually, with just a little bit of traction, try to bring the middle phalanx back up into extension. So there are some things that'll look like a sprain, but aren't. And they're worth knowing because they're ones that get treated, they're injuries that get treated a little bit differently. The traumatic boutonniere is definitely one of those. And what happens in this is that they get a disruption of the central slip insertion here. That's the extensor tendon insertion here. So they don't fully dislocate like the volar dislocation we saw on the last slide, but they do tear it. And then what happens is they lose their ability to fully pull their finger up. And so sprains can look like that, where the finger's kind of hooked down. But what will happen in a boutonniere is that the PIP will flex. It will be weak trying to get it to extend. They'll be very tender right over that central slip. And then if they kind of get watched for a few weeks, what will happen is that the DIP will start to hyperextend. And so those get treated differently. You need to splint that in extension for about 4 to 6 weeks in order to let that extensor tendon reattach. Now, again, fractures, very hard to tell just by exam. I mean, this finger is kind of swollen, a little bruised. I have no idea whether or not that is a fracture or just a sprain. Now moving on to the thumb, this gets called gamekeeper's thumb. It's really more appropriately a skier's thumb. This is a fall and you catch your thumb out to the side, especially if you've been holding a pole like with skiing. And then the thumb gets kind of forced out radially and it'll tear the ulnar collateral ligament. The ulnar collateral ligament sits deep here right next to the joint, and it sits right underneath the adductor aponeurosis, which is the kind of muscle layer right here on the inside of the thumb. It's important because if you want to try to pinch, you need the stability of that ulnar collateral ligament to be there in order to successfully be able to pinch. So when you're looking for these, they'll be tender over the inside of the thumb there at the MCP. And when you want to assess for stability, you want to flex the thumb down just a little bit and then push radially. And you always compare it to the other side. You're looking for a nice solid endpoint. And then if there's any concern, these get MRIs in order to evaluate, is it just a little stretched or is it totally torn? And then in the situation of complete tears, we talk about stenar lesion, and what that means is that here's the black dark ligament, which should really be attached here. And what's happened is that it's flipped out to the side and now it's come through that adductor aponeurosis, that fascia right there of that muscle, and now it's sitting outside of that. It's kind of buttonholes through that fascia, and now it will never reattach and heal right. Some complete tears, if the ligament's still fairly well positioned, will reattach with casting, but a stenar lesion won't. So stenars always need a surgery. Truthfully, I find surgery to be much more predictable for these acute tears, and so certainly if it were my thumb, I would get this fixed. If they're just sprained and a little bit loose, but the ligament's still attached, that'd be fine to immobilize. But and especially now we have the ability to use this internal brace, which essentially uses some labral tape or like a basically a strong, somewhere between a suture and a fabric to help augment the repair. And it almost is like putting a cast on the inside. So it allows us to be much more aggressive about letting kids go back to playing sports. I mean, once the incision's healed, I put them in a splint like this, and I've let football players go back at like between 2 and 4 weeks, which is much more aggressive than we had been in the past. So complete tears of this, I almost always fix. MCP dislocation. Someone had asked me about this, I think, last year, and I didn't have any slides on it, so I thought I would add that in this year. This is not as common, but you'll come across it every now and then. It's typically the index and the small finger. It's typically your border digits that will have this. Simple dislocation. It'll just kind of come kind of hyperextended off the back. What will happen in a complex or basically a non-reducible one is that they'll bayonet, and the metacarpal head will then buttonhole through the ligaments and the tendons volarly, and those need a surgery. Those you can't get back in. But but some of the simple ones you can. And in order to reduce that, again, you know, something's out the back, you tend to want to take all the palmar or volar structures out of the equation, so you flex everything down to take the tension off of the flexor tendons. You don't want to pull straight on these, because that'll just turn this into an irreducible one. You want to put pressure right there at the base of the proximal phalanx, again, to kind of, with just a little bit of traction, to kind of flip it back over the head. And then once they're back in, these tend to be fairly stable, so they get splinted for a short period of time, and then we let them move. So now we're going to go a little bit more proximal to the wrist. You have broad categories of ligaments. You have the intrinsic ligaments of the wrist, which connect all the little bones here, and then you have the extrinsic ligaments, which are the kind of sweeping combination of ligaments that broadly hold the carpus to the forearm. For the extrinsic ligaments, the volar ones are much, much stronger than the dorsal ones. Truthfully, you're only really going to tear these volar ligaments with a very high energy injury, and that's like a wrist dislocation. That tends to need like a motorcycle crash or something like that. It's uncommon to see those injured as part of a sports injury, although I guess it's possible. More commonly, you'll see injuries to the dorsal ligaments that across the back of the wrist. So these dorsal ligaments are really what's commonly involved in your run-of-the-mill, quote-unquote, wrist sprain. We'll talk about some of the intrinsic ligaments, scapholunate and whatnot, TSCC. We're not talking about those. These are ligaments to these straps, if you will, that kind of cross the back of the wrist. They'll be swollen back on the dorsum of the wrist. And they're shaped kind of like a triangle. And they come to a point where they all insert kind of over on the triquetrum. And so when I'm looking at somebody who's fallen and has wrist pain, but the x-rays are not really that impressive, usually you can push right over the triquetrum and they'll be tender right there, because that's usually where it's going to pull off if they're going to tear. And sometimes they might even pull off a little, you know, might even have a little fracture of the triquetrum. So you'll see that on the lateral view. So the lateral view of the wrist, see this little fleck of bone. It's really, although it's a fracture, it's really basically a run-of-the-mill wrist sprain. These are treated with just brief splinting followed by early range of motion. So now, intrinsic ligament injuries. So these are the ones that are between the carpal bones. Scapholunate, we'll spend a little bit of time on. The lunato-triquetral or LT ligament tears, these are fairly uncommon. I've only seen a handful of these. Most of them will heal kind of slowly on their own without a whole lot of fancy treatment. Okay, I've run across a couple that were persistently tender and painful. MRI showed the LT tear. And for those, I have scoped and kind of cleaned things up. And this is actually a patient of mine where these are pictures from the wrist scope. Here you can see the sort of torn ligament here. Here's the lunate, here's the triquetrum. It's pulled off of the triquetrum. This is looking from the midcarpal joint down, and there was a gap here between the lunate and the triquetrum, and actually even a step off that you could see. This is looking, again, LT here. Here's the end of the lunate. Here's the border of the triquetrum, and there, it's pretty well kind of not, as my daughter would say, cattywampus. So what I did here is just kind of cleaned all this frayed stuff up and then used a probe to reduce it in the joint and then put some pins across. So here everything's kind of cleaned up and put back together, pins for 6 weeks, and he did quite well. But that's pretty uncommon to have to wind up doing that. Now, on the other hand, scapholunate ligaments, These are tough because there's not really great treatment for these. The rehab's really long, and you may still end up with arthritis no matter what we do. But we do try to catch them because certainly earlier treatment is much more successful as far as getting the ligament to heal. So these will, they'll complain of fairly central, you can push right over the scapholunate interval and they may be tender right there. Sometimes they'll have a hard time bringing their wrist up into full extension or putting pressure on it. Pain with push-ups, so they're not able to do that type of thing, or they'll feel kind of a clicking in the wrist. They may even have limited motion where they can't even fully extend the wrist. And the reason that we care and we try to, especially in an adult, in the adolescent population, and these will be older adolescents, these will be like, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20, this won't tend to happen in the younger adolescent group, is that it will lead to a progressive form of arthritis if you don't stabilize between the bones, because I tell patients it's like driving your car out of alignment. You tear the ligament here between the scaphoid and the lunate, and this is a pretty extreme case. There's a lot of widening here. This is pretty obvious. What happens is that now you've lost that linkage, and it wears out this portion first, and then the midcarpal joint. This is the last area to get affected, but it progresses through the wrist in a very predictable way, which if you end up with wrist arthritis in your early 20s, it's kind of an unfortunate thing. So. Again, here and on examination, this is what it looks like in a cadaveric specimen between the scaphoid here and the lunate, and here's the ligament attaching the two bones. They'll be tender right over this interval on the back, and again, decreased or painful extension. The Watson shift test, basically, and I'll show this in the breakout session, but you put pressure here on the distal pole of the scaphoid, kind of trying to push the scaphoid off the back of the wrist, and then you rotate from ulnar into radial deviation, you feel the scaphoid come back to you. If the ligament's torn, it will kind of stay up and you can let it go and it'll clunk back into the wrist. The key is to compare it to the other side, because especially women, girls tend to be more loose jointed. You can have a clunk and it may be normal. So it's about asymmetry, pain between the sides. Radiographs, you might see widening. This is a pretty obvious tear here where there's a space. All these lines should be pretty equally spaced. This one's pretty wide, so that's pretty indicative of a tear, but a lot of times they're not, they're pretty subtle. If when in doubt, we'll get an MRI arthrogram where they inject dye into the radial carpal joint. They watch to see if the dye trickles into the midcarpal joint, because if it does, it indicates at least a partial tear. Or here, you'll see, here's the ligament almost always tears off of the scaphoid. So here it is remaining here on the lunate, but the gap right there. So for a complete tear, these really need to be repaired fairly acutely, because after you get past 3-4 weeks, it starts to be harder to get it to heal right. They need a cast and pins for close to 8 weeks. They're not usually very happy with this. And unfortunately, they still may end up with arthritis, but we still do the best that we can to try to stabilize the wrist. Unfortunately, if you get these really late, the reconstructive options are just not that appealing. They often will stiffen the wrist. Dr. Green would say that, we have lots of operations in orthopedics for one of two reasons, either because everything works great or nothing works great. And unfortunately for scapholunate, it's still kind of an unsolved problem. Now, partial tears, I'll see these not infrequently. They'll just kind of have this lingering wrist pain, and it doesn't look like there's big widening or that things are out of alignment or anything, but they have a partial tear potentially on MRI. These often benefit from, they'll have like a flap of the ligament that's just hanging out in the wrist, it's irritating them, and so I'll scope these, clean them up. If it really looks like there's instability that you see on the scope between the scaphoid and the lunate, then I'll put pins in. But here's some scope pictures. Here's a normal-looking ligament. Here's the ligament between the scaphoid and the lunate. Here you can see a complete tear, and it gets this frayed look very quickly, and that becomes harder to repair. And then here's kind of a partial tear where you can slide a probe underneath it, but it's still kind of attached up here. Now, finally, we'll talk about the TFCC. This is basically ulnar-sided wrist pain, or pain on the ulnar side of the wrist following some sort of trauma. We call it the TFCC for triangular fibrocartilage complex. So T for triangle kind of attaches the radius to the ulna to the carpus. It's that kind of corner of the wrist. And it's made of a bunch of different stuff. You've got ligaments, you've got kind of a disc in the center and I kind of liken these, I try to compare them almost to like a meniscus in the knee. It's fairly similar in a lot of ways. But you can definitely tear different portions of it. The way that they're, the way that these tend to happen, sometimes it'll just be a fall, but I've also seen these happen with an acute kind of rotational injury. So like, for example, if you're using a drill and then it binds and it twists the wrist, that's another way that these will kind of get injured. And these are just this lingering all in the wrist pain after an injury that just doesn't really improve. They can be associated with distal radius fractures, and they can also have associated DRUJ symptoms or distal radial ulnar joint symptoms. So the swivel joint, so a lot of pain with rotation or potentially clicking or instability there. That's really the key in evaluating these. So they're classified in traumatic causes and degenerative causes, and we're not going to really bother with the degenerative causes in this talk, but the traumatic ones are basically, they can be torn in varying locations. They can be torn off the radius, they can be torn off of the styloid, they can just have kind of a, they can have a distal tear, this is a central tear, and then this is when they get torn off of the radius. So they can injure in different areas, and depending on where they're injured dictates some of the treatment. But really what dictates treatment for this is going to be whether or not the DRUJ is stable. So if the DRUJ is stable, these don't necessarily need any kind of fancy treatment. But when you're examining these, they'll be tender in the fovea, and that's that soft spot just distal to the ulnar styloid. There'll be pain when you compress the ulnar carpal joint, so extension, kind of ulnar deviation, that'll be painful. Pain sometimes with pressure on the wrist as well, but usually on the ulnar side. So again, here's just some illustrations of these exam findings. Again, kind of you stick your thumb just distal to the ulna, you'll find that soft spot that is right at the fovea, and they'll be pretty point tender there. And again, here they'll get pain when you kind of bring the wrist into extension and ulnar deviation. DRUJ instability now. Sometimes it's obvious where, gosh, like distal ulna is really sticking out a lot compared to the other side. But the key is you have to compare to the other side, because some people just have a prominent ulna, and that has to do with the relative lengths of the bones. But if you look at both sides, you may see one that looks more prominent than the other. And that's a suggestion of some underlying instability. And then also the piano key test, where you essentially shock the distal ulna relative to the radius, and you can test that in different sort of positions of forearm rotation, and you may get some asymmetries and instability compared with the other side. On plain films, sometimes you'll see some widening, but again, that can also be very positional from how the x-ray is taken. Or you'll see the distal, I mean, this is a frame dislocation where this distal ulna is like way out the back compared to the radius. They should at least line up to a certain extent. But again, if it's not a perfect lateral, that can change. And here, the other thing is to watch them, you know, pronate and supinate. And if they're fully dislocated, they won't be able to supinate. And here's just clinically what it'll look like, kind of a prominent distal ulna. But if there's concern about this, an MRI arthrogram is typically what we order. Again, the arthrogram injects dye into the radial carpal joint. Again, you're looking for it to kind of pool in places where it shouldn't. You shouldn't have an ability for the dye to kind of come down here in between the radius and the ulna and the DRUJ, but here it has. Here's a normal looking TSCC. So this is dark black structure attaching here on the fovea, which is marked by the star. Here on this image, you can see the ligament here, and then all this white stuff where it's been pulled off of the radial, the ulnar styloid, excuse me. So again, just because the TSCC is torn, it does not absolutely mean that it needs surgery. It's all about whether or not the DRUJ is unstable. If it's unstable, it needs to be fixed. If it's not, it's kind of it's dealer's choice, really. So a lot of times I'll let these rest, splint them, sometimes I'll inject them. I usually like to know what the MRI shows before I do injections, but that's also debatable. But for kind of high level athletes, sometimes if it's a complete tear and they don't want to mess around with just sort of splinting, biding their time, wondering if it'll heal on its own, then sometimes we'll talk about surgery. But if the DRUJ is stable, if there's no requirement for these to be fixed. Now, as far as how we fix them, I do a scope to take a look at the ligament. If it's just kind of a little central tear, again, kind of similar to the meniscus, if it's just a little flap of the ligament that just needs to be cleaned up, we'll do that. And this is an example of a central perforation. You can kind of see this flap of ligament sticking up here that can irritate the wrist. Clean that up, and then you're left with a nice smooth edge, very similar to a meniscus. However, if it's pulled off of the ulnar styloid, and here you can here the probe is getting passed kind of underneath the ligament, you can almost lift it up and pull it into the joint. Those need to be reattached, and they can be reattached in a number of different ways. We have all arthroscopic ways or some small open ways of basically reattaching the ligament where it needs to. I don't usually pin the DREJ, but I do recommend casting for 6 weeks. It's probably not full return until closer to 3 months. So just to summarize, so when do you need to start sending them to me or somebody else? Again, anything you have to reduce needs some sort of imaging. If they're very point tender over bone and it remains that way after the acute injury and nothing's obviously crooked, probably needs to be evaluated for a fracture. I mean, some of them are obvious. This is an open dislocation of the PEIP. This is a little less obvious. I'm not sure exactly what's going on in there. So, if there's an asymmetry in the stability when you're talking about scapholunate ligaments or with the DREJ, if there's an asymmetry in stability, that probably needs a more rapid referral because, again, those ligament injuries tend to do better, heal better if they're fixed more acutely. And, I mean, again, I didn't talk really about scaphoid because I really kept this as a soft tissue injury, but if you are looking at a wrist and they're persistently tender over the snuff box, or if they have pain with resisted pronation, you just don't want to miss a scaphoid. You just don't. Because, I mean, I see these, and a lot of times the kids just won't complain because they don't want to be, I see them all in December after playoffs. Sort of linger until the end of the season, I'll see them. It's much better to get to scaphoids early. But in general, if you've got pain and motion that's not improving rapidly over a week or two, it's probably worth a referral. So again, thank you so much for inviting me back to talk, and I look forward to kind of going over the more of the details of the hand and wrist exam and the breakout sessions, but I'm happy to answer any broad questions or any specific questions about soft tissue injuries. Thanks.
Any questions? I have a question. Open dislocation right here.
Oh, sorry. Somebody.
Open dislocation of the finger. What's your recommendation as far as if you have an open dislocation? From a physician standpoint, you want that reduced or not reduced?
I mean, if it's grossly contaminated, like there's grass in there, it probably needs to be washed out and reduced in questionable order. I mean, I think that if you can somehow kind of at least wash it off grossly and pop it back in, it could be I don't always think that those necessarily need to be sutured closed in the emergency room. But I would personally just get the joint back in because a lot of those are fairly stable once they're back in. So, wash it out if you can, reduce it. If it's grossly contaminated, probably just send it to the ER so they can do a more formal washout before reducing it. If there's really dirt in the wound, if there's not, you could just do a kind of a cursory washout, reduce it, and then I wouldn't close it, and I would have them do some warm soapy water soaks on the wound to let it to heal and keep it kind of clean, if that makes sense.
Okay, the second one, nobody else has asked questions so long. So.
With injections?
Yes.
There seems to be the ongoing anti-inflammatory versus potential deterioration of the tissue.
Mm-hmm.
How do you
balance that? Yeah, so for example, so TFCC would be a really good example of that potential problem, right? You have potentially a ligament injury. Let's just take the DREJ out of the equation because that would force us into surgery anyway. So then you have a tear of the TFCC, which may or may not improve symptomatically. Certainly the healing potential is better the earlier you fix it, and if you're and also without steroid, right? If you put an injection in and then you think to maybe fix it later, could that decrease the healing potential of a ligament? Yeah, it could. That's why I tend to not like doing injections without kind of knowing what the type of tear it is. So that's where I think MRI can be helpful. So let's say, for example, it's just a little hole in the middle of the ligament. Maybe it has a little, just a little central perforation. It's not a big tear off of the capsule or off the fovea. I think that'd be fine to try and inject and just let it kind of see if that helps it kind of calm down, because I'm not potentially looking at repairing it down the road if it doesn't get better. So for the peripheral tears, again, we'll just, you kind of need to take stock of what, who the patient is, as far as what they need to do and how quickly they need to get in a particular, into a particular place. I mean, I think that kind of helps guide me, if that answers your question. I think if there's a possibility out there that I'm going to repair it, then I'm less enthused about doing an injection. But if it's like a little partial scapholunate injury where there's not instability or a little hole in the TFCC, a lot of times an injection, like the ligament edge is kind of an irritating factor in the wrist. So the injection kind of calms it down, and then it doesn't bother them. And if it doesn't bother them, great. They don't need any kind of surgery. Yes, sir.
The next one is, you know, so many times we see hand and wrist injuries in football, middle of the season. So what's your take home on what needs surgery immediately and what can make it through the end of the season? I guess my question would be your ulnar collaterals, your scaphoid fractures, your TFCCs, you know, things like that. Are they things that you can say, okay, we got two games left in the season, let's finish it out, or no, we need to fix it?
It's a good question. So so PIP, I think you need to just make sure that that's not an unstable joint, because that needs to get fixed like within a week. So if the PIP is dislocated, has a fracture, that can't wait. That needs to sort of be evaluated urgently, because if the joint's out, you have a very small period of time to very easily fix that. So as far as wrist injuries, scaphoid, that honestly can wait. I mean, you know, following surgery for scaphoids kind of depends on where you are in the season. I think if you diagnose a scaphoid waist fracture mid-season, I think it is better to fix it. But if you had a couple games left, I'd let them finish the season and fix it at the end. I don't know that makes a big difference. Proximal pulls may be another ball of wax, because a proximal pull scaphoid has crappy blood supply and doesn't heal well. And I would not love to sit on that, although I have. A lot of times what'll happen with scaphoids is that they don't hurt that bad, so they kind of wait on them anyway. So you sort of come in and they're already like 3 weeks out, where you're kind of looking at surgery, but is surgery going to make a big difference 3 weeks later? Probably not. So I'm okay waiting on scaphoids. Scapholunate, complete tears probably need to be fixed within 3 weeks. I just don't see that commonly in this population. It's usually slightly older. TFCCs, those I think also could probably wait. So I think proximal pull scaphoids, complete injuries to scapholunate, I'd rather get to those and fix those fairly early. And the PIP, I hate any kind of finger fracture. The problem is too, is that finger fractures heal within like 3 weeks. I mean, that's all I got, you know? So if they're off, or they need, you know, maybe to be reduced and pinned, I gotta get to them kind of early. It's very different than other bones, like distal radius. I can fix that even 2-3 weeks. 3 weeks is literally as long as I cast my phalanx fractures. So those kind of need just a little bit of quicker attention. Not like, oh, just wait and see. I mean, if you're at all concerned for a phalanx fracture, it's much better to send those quickly. You're welcome.
A couple of housekeeping items. We're fixing over the breakout sessions. If you can, try and stay somewhat, you know.